The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, we're really getting into something complex. Hunting. It's one of those practices in America that's just incredibly loaded, right?
Deeply misunderstood, too. It sits right at this intersection of big arguments we have about, well, ethics, our food, the environment. It's a tangle.
And we're using Janny Deserts Hunting, a cultural history, as our guide. Our goal here is to unpack this huge contradiction.
Yeah, a really surprising one. We're going to explore how hunting, which, you know, many people today see as purely destructive, actually became the driving force behind the conservation movement, the very movement that saved a lot of North American wildlife.
It's strange because when you think conservation, you might picture someone like John Muir,
right?
Pure preservationist.
Right. Keep humans out.
Exactly. But Dizzard's work totally flips that script. Mm. It shows it was hunters who first pushed for and, crucially, paid for the system we still rely on. And that's really why this book is so relevant for you listening. It's kind of a shortcut to understanding these deep cultural divides, often between urban and rural viewpoints today.
Yeah, it helps explain why talks about nature get so heated. It's often less about the actual biology and more about these clashing worldviews and values.
So to navigate this tricky terrain, we need someone who understands both sides. And that's Jan E. Dizzard. He's the Charles Hamilton Houston Professor of American Culture and Sociology Emeritus at Amherst College.
And his specialty is perfect for this, environmental sociology, basically how our culture shapes conflicts over using nature. He spent his career looking at these kinds of controversial practices.
But here's what makes his view so valuable, I think. He's not just an academic looking from the outside.
Oh.
He's also a hunter himself.
Personally.
Okay. Yeah. That's really interesting. So he gets the tradition from the inside. Exactly. Mm. But he still brings that rigorous, you know, objective sociological analysis. He's not just cheerleading for hunting, but he's not condemning it based on assumptions either. Mm. He treats it like the complex cultural thing it is.
Yeah, that balance is key. He can be critical, but also respectful.
Right. So let's get into his main argument then. What's the core idea?
Okay, so Dizzard really wants to move the whole debate past the simple good-bad views. You know, it's not just some weekend hobby, but it's also not just senseless killing.
He sees it more as like a mirror.
Yeah, exactly. A cultural mirror, he calls it. Something that reflects society's values, our anxieties, and how things have massively changed over time.
And the really fascinating part is how the meaning of hunting has shifted so dramatically. I mean, it started as pure survival, obviously.
Right. Necessity.
Then in Europe, it becomes the status symbol. Mm-hmm. Like only the nobles get to do it.
Yeah. Very exclusive.
And then it lands where it is now in the U.S., this recreational activity that's, well, constantly debated.
And the absolute core of the book, the big question Dizzard tackles is, how on earth did this thing that caused so much destruction?
Like with the bison.
Right. How did that become the engine for saving wildlife later on?
It's this whole transformation he traces.
Yeah.
You go from the market hunter in the 19th century, you know, just slaughtering for profit.
The ecological destroyer.
Yeah. To the sportsman conservationist. Mm-hmm. The person who starts talking about ethics, demanding rules, setting up funding. The very things that pulled species back from the brink. It's a messy, ironic story.
Okay, let's trace that story. Dizzard starts way back, right?
Medieval Europe.
Yep. And back then, hunting was absolutely not for everyone.
No way.
It was strictly for the aristocracy. The king's game, they called it. There were all these laws, not just about who could hunt, but where and what, all designed to show who was boss.
So hunting was basically performing your social status.
Totally. A ritual of power. Hmm. But then Europeans get to North America.
And everything changes completely. The sheer abundance of game, plus this new democratic ideology, it just blew up the old system. Hunting wasn't for the elite anymore.
It became what, like a basic right?
A fundamental right of the common man, yeah. Oh. It turned into this powerful symbol of American freedom, you know, self-reliance, a direct rejection of that old European class system. That's why it got so deeply embedded in the culture here.
But that freedom, it had a dark side, right? This crisis of abundance he talks about.
Oh, definitely. That freedom, unchecked, combined with new tech like railroads opening up markets and better guns. It led straight to ecological disaster in the 1800s.
This is the era of the market hunter.
Exactly. And the examples are just brutal. Dizzard points to the near wipeout of the American bison, millions killed, mostly just for hides.
And the passenger pigeon?
Even more shocking, maybe. Went from being likely the most numerous bird on the continent to completely extinct, gone, wiped out by commercial hunting on an industrial scale.
Wow, it's hard to even imagine that scale of killing.
It really is. And it just shattered that myth of America having endless, inexhaustible resources. Clearly, that early, unrestricted approach was a catastrophe waiting to happen.
Okay, so here's the pivot, the irony. The movement to save the wildlife came from the hunters.
Yeah, not from people trying to ban hunting altogether, but from the really passionate hunters themselves.
Wait, how does that work? How do you go from, you know, marken hunting to conservation? Who were these people?
Well, they tended to be wealthier, more educated guys.
Yeah.
Sportsmen, they called themselves. Think Theodore Roosevelt or George Bird Grinnell, who edited a big outdoor magazine.
Okay.
And they were horrified by the destruction, not just on moral grounds initially, but because the market hunters were destroying the very animals they loved to hunt.
Ah, so it started with self-interest, like, hey, save some for us.
Kind of, yeah. A pragmatic starting point. But it quickly became more than that. It evolved into a real moral and political cause. Roosevelt and Grinnell, they co-founded the Boone and Crockett Club.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, it became hugely influential. They started pushing for ethical hunting codes and, crucially, lobbying government for things like hunting seasons, bag limits, protected areas.
And that lobbying, that push, that's what led to this whole system.
Pretty much directly. It led to what we now call the North American model of wildlife conservation. It's been incredibly successful, actually, and it rests on these two main pillars that those early hunter conservationists developed.
Okay, let's break those down. Pillar one, wildlife as a public trust. What does that mean, simply?
Think of it like the air we breathe or national parks. The idea is wildlife doesn't belong to any one person or landowner. It belongs to everyone, the public.
Okay.
So the government, the state, has to manage it based on science for the benefit of all citizens now and in the future. It stops wildlife from just being private property someone can wipe out.
Right, that makes sense. Protects it from private exploitation. Okay, pillar two, the funding. You mentioned this act, Pittman-Robertson.
Yes, the Pittman-Robertson Act of 1937. This was, honestly, a stroke of genius.
How so?
Instead of conservation relying on, you know, hoping the government allocates money each year or on charity, this act put an excise tax, like a sales tax, on all firearms, ammo, and even archery gear.
Okay. And where does that tax money go?
Directly and specifically into conservation. It's earmarked only for things like buying land for habitat, restoring habitats, doing wildlife research.
Wow. So the people actually using the resource, the hunters and shooters, are legally required to pay for its upkeep.
Exactly. It's a user pays, user benefits system. And it created this massive, reliable, dedicated stream of funding. It's why hunters have effectively been the main financial backers of conservation in the U.S. for decades, benefiting all sorts of wildlife, not just game animals.
That's actually incredible. I didn't realize it worked quite like that.
It's pretty unique.
Yeah.
And alongside the legal and financial parts, they also created a moral code.
Ah, the fair chase thing.
Yep. The ethic of fair chase. This was a set of rules they imposed on themselves. Things designed to make hunting a sport, not just killing. Banning certain technology, giving the animal a chance to escape, basically adding difficulty and restraint.
So it wasn't just about efficiency anymore. It was about the process, the ethics of it.
Precisely. It was their way of justifying hunting in a changing world, making it a ritual of skill and respect, not just a harvest. That self-limitation was crucial for its social acceptance or social license to continue.
Okay, this history really clarifies so much about the debates today. Let's pull out those key themes Dizzard uses to connect the past to the present. That central irony keeps coming up.
It's unavoidable, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's theme number one, the paradox. The same group involved in near destruction becomes the savior and primary funder. It just blows apart that simple hunter versus environmentalist narrative. The reality is way more tangled.
And the second theme you mentioned earlier, this urban-rural disconnect.
Yeah, Dizzard really emphasizes this. He sees a lot of the modern anti-hunting feeling less as being about wildlife management and more as a symptom of, well, how disconnected many people in cities are from where food comes from the realities of life and death in nature.
Like if your meat just appears shrink-wrapped, the idea of actually killing an animal feels alien.
Exactly. It becomes morally abstract, maybe even offensive. So it's a culture clash as much as anything.
Yeah.
And that leads to his third theme, hunting as that cultural mirror.
Right. It was never just about getting food or killing animals.
Never simply about that. It's always been about making meaning, reflecting social class back in Europe, reflecting freedom in early America, reflecting ideas about masculinity, tradition, a connection to nature. The act itself carries all this cultural weight.
It's the meaning, the ritual, the code. That's what gives it staying power, even when it's not needed for survival. Dessert puts things so well sometimes. Are there a few core statements that really capture his argument?
Definitely. I think the first one is just that. Hunting has never been simply about killing animals. It's always been about making meaning. That explains its persistence, you know?
Yeah, captures that symbolic core. What else?
This one really nails the American context. The democratization of hunting in America represented one of the most radical departures from European tradition, challenging centuries-old assumptions about social hierarchy and access to natural resources. It highlights hunting as, like, a declaration of independence.
I like that. Hunting as a political statement.
And then about the ethics. The ethic of fair chase was a brilliant cultural invention. It transformed a potentially brutal act of killing into a noble ritual governed by self-imposed restraint. That really explains how they managed to keep hunting morally justifiable for many, even as society changed.
Okay, this is way more than just history. It feels like there are real takeaways for how we approach things today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For policymakers, for instance, it shows that, hey, conservation funding can come directly from the users of a resource.
Yeah.
You don't have to assume only anti-use groups care about conservation. Building broad coalitions, including hunters, can be really effective.
And just for understanding each other better.
Yeah, massively. It gives you a framework for that cultural divide. If you're not a hunter, understanding this history, the funding model, the ethical framework, it adds nuance. And for hunters, it underscores why clearly communicating that fair chase ethic is so important. They need to show it's a regulated, principled activity.
And Desard's point about food, it makes you think, doesn't it?
It really does. It kind of forces you to confront the reality behind neatly packaged food. Whether it's hunting or farming, life is taken. The book pushes for a more honest look at that process, maybe closing some of that distance the supermarket creates.
One last application that struck me, that fair chase idea is self-regulation.
Oh, yeah. That's a powerful example. Here's a group that, facing potential backlash, created and enforced its own ethical rules to maintain public acceptance. You could apply that model to so many fields today, right?
Yeah.
AI ethics, finance. How do industries police themselves effectively?
That's a great point. So stepping back from it all, what was the biggest surprise or takeaway for you from Desard's work?
For me, I think it was really internalizing just how pragmatic the origins of American conservation were. It wasn't all lofty ideals initially. It was driven by this, well, informed self-interest of hunters wanting to protect the resource they valued. It was a human, maybe even messy, solution that just happened to work incredibly well.
Yeah, I felt that too. The pragmatic core is surprising. For me, the lasting thought is how much the current debate is really a clash of philosophies about nature itself. Like, do you see nature primarily as this pristine thing to be observed from a distance, a backdrop? Or do you see it as a system that humans are fundamentally part of, which includes playing roles like predator, albeit ethically managed ones? Dizzard really clarifies that underlying difference in perspective.
That's a really sharp way to put it. And it leads right into the big, maybe worrying question for the future.
Right. If fewer people hunt, if society gets even more disconnected from these ecological realities, what happens to that incredibly successful North American model? Can it survive without its main financial engine, the hunters themselves?
That is definitely something worth thinking about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.